Well, hello everybody who's tuned in to today's Weber Training teleclass. My name is Maria Benalik. I'm one of the UK organisers of the teleclass programme for 2011. And I'm really pleased to invite Doctor, not Professor, although he'd love to be a Professor, Dr. Andy Nichols from the University of Plymouth, a colleague of mine in the university. Andy started his career in infection control in the hospital environment and then moved into community infection control down here in the glorious southwest of England, Cornwall, and he worked there for 7 years. He came over to the University of Plymouth in 2003, where he worked on and completed his PhD looking at organisational learning and how that can enhance infection control practice in the clinical setting. He also has a really keen interest in the climate change agenda, and he's currently working within a team at the University of Plymouth looking at sustainable waste management in healthcare. And I'm really pleased to invite Andy to come and talk to us. So I'll just hand over the phone because we're actually in the same room together today, which is great. And over to you, Andy. He's going to talk to us about climate change and communicable disease. What are the risks?
Hello. Thank you very much. Thank you, Maria, for inviting me. And thank you for downgrading me from professor back down to doctor again. If anybody does want to offer me a job as a professor, though, I'll be more than happy to listen. Yes, my talk this afternoon will be on, as you see on the first slide, the climate change and communicable disease, what are the risks? I'll just stress now that in the discussion that I'll be doing for the next 45 minutes to an hour or so, I'd imagine, will be predominantly focused upon the UK and on kind of temperate regions. I will kind of wander off occasionally and look at other parts of the world and discuss other parts of the world, but I think it's only fair that I just say at the very outset that my research and the work that I've done so far has been pretty much UK focused, because that's where I live and that's where I work basically. So if we just move on to the first slide, which should now be aims and objectives. First one there, discuss a review of the literature. This was a review of the literature that I undertook, I think it was a couple of years ago now, which resulted in a paper published in the British Journal of Infection Control. And rather than include details of the different papers that were discussed in that review on each individual slide, I'll put a few references and a list of the literature at the end of the presentation. So there'll be a few pages of relevant literature to look at if you're interested in that kind of thing. So my first aims and objectives will be discuss a review of the literature. Secondly, I intend to present some examples from practice. This will be from my own kind of clinical practice and from areas of clinical practice that I know of and I'm familiar with. So we'll look at an E. coli 157 outbreak and also an interesting kind of pseudo-outbreak, if we get the chance, which isn't so much to do with any kind of infectious pathogen, but more to do with problems caused by the vector that may have been a causative organism in an outbreak, and the problems that it caused for the population and the concerns of the population around where this kind of pseudo-outbreak occurred. And then thirdly, I'll look at consider future actions and risks. And again, I'll apologise now, because I think because of the kind of topic that we're dealing with, if we're looking at climate change and the risks and possible problems associated with climate change, then I think it's an awful lot of this is on, we could call it speculation, and it's prediction. It depends on what the climate scientists tell us the changes that are likely to be. And as a result of that, then we in public health and in communicable disease management, we have to kind of speculate and plan for what those future risks might be and then what actions we might have to take as a result of it. So I will apologise. Some of it may well sound a bit kind of speculative, but it's based on the evidence in the literature that was found during the review of the literature that I initially undertook. So I'm working on the assumption that we all agree that climate change or global warming to some extent exists. We're all happy that that phenomenon does actually exist and it is causing us a problem. And whether you agree that this is anthropogenic, in other words, man-made risk or man-made problem, I'm not sure just how relevant that is. I think the thing that we have to accept is whether or not we're happy that climate change does exist, it is a genuine phenomenon, and that it may make some changes to the way that communicable diseases behave and the spread of them. If that's the case, then I don't think we have to worry about whether or not it's man-made risk or not. We really need to address the problems caused by it, and then start to think of how we're going to address it, and that's what we'll discuss. So if we look at the potential impacts of climate change, you can see them listed. Oh, yes, you can move on to the next slide. Beg your pardon. I am supposed to tell you when to move on to the next slide. Fortunately, Maria's here holding my hand, and she will tell me when I get it wrong. So, yes, move on to the next slide, which should now say potential health impacts of climate change. And listed there, you can see a variety of things that you find evidence in the literature suggesting that these are the potential health impacts of climate change. If you were to choose to do a quick search of just the popular literature if you decide to go and Google stuff, then you may well find that there's evidence to suggest that these potential impacts of climate change, they're already being linked to problems that we are currently facing or have faced in the not-too-distant past. For argument's sake, I did a quick search of this myself in the last week, and if you look up heat waves and you try and look at the way that they may have been associated with climate change, you may see stories reported about the heat wave in Europe in 2003, where it was estimated that up to about 40,000 extra deaths were contributed to by this highly unusual heat wave that covered large expanses of mainland Europe. Similarly, if you look at the kind of storms that people are predicting may occur and as a result of climate change, you might see or you might remember the stories of the floods and the storms that occurred in China in 2007. On this occasion, reports suggest that up to 200 million people were impacted by those storms, were affected by those storms. And if you look at the stories and you look at the reports of it, there are people that are in their opinions and they've had things published where they are suggesting that these storms may well have been contributed to by climate change. Again, we look at the floods. If we talk about floods, those of us in the UK, if we look this week, we'll find that there was stuff published in the popular press suggesting that in 2011, this country, the UK, is now more at risk of the kind of floods that we've been seeing over the last few years. Many of us remember seeing floods on the television in the north of England. In Cornwall, quite recently, we've had unusual flooding, and it does seem to be that there are increasing instances of these kind of problems. Next, you can see on the list there we're talking about the potential impacts of climate change and their contribution to fires. Well, many of us will have seen the television coverage and coverage in the newspapers of the fires that were recently in Australia. And again, a quick search of looking through the literature and looking through the reports of those kind of problems, and you'll see that in parts of Australia, they are now seriously looking at whether or not there is an increased risk of the kind of fires that they had recently and whether or not climate change has contributed to that increasing risk. Again, on the list there, you'll see droughts, and of course, right at this very moment in 2011, there is this, you may well have seen reported on the news or in the media, that there is this drought actually going on at the moment in parts of East Africa. And again, it doesn't take too long to search the literature to find suggestions that these kind of phenomena are already in existence, and there's the argument that they may well increase in distribution and increase in number as a result of climate change. And their appearance in different parts of the world may also start to change. Certainly in the UK, there's evidence to suggest that these unusual weather events are starting to increase, and we'll talk about that later. The bottom of the list there, infectious diseases, that's what we'll come on to later on, and we'll hopefully be able to talk about that in some more depth as we go through the presentation. So if we just move on to the next slide. Still on potential health impacts of climate change, I'm sorry that I'm kind of labouring the point of this, but maybe I think it's worth it to just to stress that it is a fairly wide-scale problem, and if it is anything like as bad as people suggest it might be, or if it is as influential as people suggest it might well be, then we have to consider that it will have a very broad impact on lifestyles and the way that we behave throughout the entire globe, really. So we're looking at agriculture and fisheries there. And again, there is evidence in the literature to suggest that there are rising ocean temperatures. And as a result of these rising ocean temperatures, then, of course, then that will have an impact on the population of marine species, their distribution, knock-on effects. You can see that will have an impact on things like fisheries and food and abilities of people to make a living. Also, the impact of climate change on fisheries, there's the phenomenon of acidification of the sea, which has an impact on the ability of the smaller organisms in the sea to carry on their process of calcification. And you might think, well, how does that impact on us as humans? Well, that process of calcification, that's what an awful lot of these plankton rely upon for their as part of their life cycle. Now, the plankton are the base level, the very bottom level of the food chain within the sea. So if an impact is made upon that base level, that bottom level of the food chain within the seas, then it doesn't take too much to imagine how that might have an impact further up. And, of course, at the top of that food chain, there are human beings. So, again, you can see the potential impacts of climate change there through agriculture and fisheries. In terms of ecosystems and economies as well, we can predict that there may well be changes to energy costs and changes to the way that food is produced and food production. And with the impact of higher temperatures, some people are predicting that there may be sort of wholesale extinctions of particular species of animals. So you can see that will be these changes, or there are predicted to be these changes in things like agriculture, fisheries, ecosystems, and economics. And then it doesn't take too much to imagine that with those kind of changes going on and the things that we talked about in the previous slide, the heat waves, storms, floods, fires, droughts, potentially impact on infectious diseases, then we can see that climate change certainly does have the potential for a huge impact on human health and well-being. Hopefully I've kind of made my argument there that if we do accept that climate change is a phenomenon that genuinely is happening, then we do need to kind of consider whether or not there will be changes that will impact on our health and well-being. And if we agree that there will be, then perhaps it's down to us as healthcare practitioners to start to think about how we might go about managing that. So if we move on to the next slide, which should now say natural events, environmental change and health, the kind of impacts that I'm thinking about, the impacts on health and well-being, examples might be as a result of the flash flooding that we talked about earlier, and examples of outbreaks of E. coli 157 in the UK, which I'll talk about in a bit more detail later on, because certainly we've had an outbreak in the not-too-distant past that probably could be linked to the kind of freakish, unusual weather events that we're more likely to see in the UK if climate change predictions actually come to pass as predicted. And there's also examples of increased incidence of tick-borne infections in Europe, which, again, we'll talk about in a little bit more depth later on when we talk about vector-borne infections. And then moving on to the next slide. Of course, there is a historical perspective that we can always draw back upon. I mean, we've talked about the potential changes and the changes that may be occurring already, but we shouldn't ignore the fact that there is this historical perspective that we need to be aware of. And certainly, if you look at changes in climate, from the history, it shows us that changes in the climate will have an impact on the environment and will have an impact upon the disease problems that we might have within that environment. So for argument's sake, we can look at, we know that there were changes in the climate in the not too distant past. For example, in the 1300s to the 1600s, there was known to be high volcanic activity throughout the globe, across the world. And this was known as the Little Ice Age. So there was this tiny period of time in terms of the life cycle of the entire planet. But for about 300 years ago, there was this little ice age which caused changes to the environment and changes to the climate. And I think during those kind of times here in the UK, the River Thames would freeze over and people would go skating and hold markets in the middle of the river, which we can't do now. But we know that in the past there has been changes in the climate and they do occur, and we have to get on with them. We also know that there have been changes in the environment in the past. If we look back to a historical example, pre the Industrial Revolution in this country, everybody lived, well, most people lived in a sort of agricultural agrarian kind of setting. And then people flocked into the towns and the cities and were living cheek by jowl in fairly close and prolonged contact with each other. And again, you can imagine that if you bring lots and lots of people from different parts of the nation, from different nations, bring them all together, keep them close together, and that will have an impact on the way that the disease epidemiology will be seen within that population group. And then finally, second to last on that list, we see changes in patterns of disease. Again, from a historical perspective, we know that diseases will, and the patterns of their infectious diseases and their incidence and their prevalence will change depending on the circumstances that they find themselves in. And again, if you look back at another historical example, we can look at the impact of infections in Central and Southern and South America following the invasion by the conquistadors in the, I think it was the 16th century. I'm not a historian, but I think I've got the right century. And this introduced infections and pathogens to Central and South America that the native populations had never seen before. And millions died as a result of that because they just had no knowledge of it. The impact was huge. So again, we can see that changes in climate, changes in the environment, and changes in the way that pathogens behave in the circumstances that they find themselves in are likely to have a huge impact on incidence and prevalence of infectious diseases. And of course, none of this is new. And if you look at things, go back to ancient Greece, you've got Hippocrates there who identified the significance of the air, the water, the places, and the circumstances that we found ourselves in. So you can see there's nothing really new, is there, in infectious disease management? It's all been found there before. We just have to keep learning the lessons of the past and applying it to our present day. So moving on to the next slide, which should say healthcare practitioner's responsibility with a question mark. Hopefully, I am making an argument now that climate change does exist, and if it does exist, it may well have an impact on the incidence and prevalence of pathogens and infectious diseases. And if that is the case, if we accept that is occurring, maybe we have to ask the question, do we have, us as healthcare practitioners, do we have a responsibility to take any action in regard to this? Well, I would argue that in regard to the first bullet point there, promoting the health of the public, then yes, I mean, clearly we do, so particularly those of us that are tasked with working in public health and we're involved in the community at large. But I would say that for any of us, that I'd imagine that that's pretty much a given. We do have a responsibility for promoting the health of the public. The second one there, protect the environment. Maybe we should be asking ourselves that. Do we have a responsibility as healthcare practitioners, whether or not we're doctors, nurses, physios, whatever, to protect the environment? Are we answer that? Arguably, yes. Again, particularly if our job role, our task is in public health in the wider, broadest sense. If we know that the environment is presenting a risk to the population group that we're responsible for, then I would argue that we certainly do have a responsibility for taking some kind of action to protect that environment and to make that environment as safe as we possibly can. And the third bullet point there, work to prevent, mitigate and adapt to climate change and its impacts. Well, again, I would argue that yes, we do, if we accept the previous bullet point, and I think we have to accept the third one there as well. And maybe that's the way that we work to protect that environment. We look to mitigate the effects of climate change. We look to adapt to the effects of climate change. And in by doing that, then we can hopefully reduce the risk to the population groups that we're responsible for. If you're still with me and you agree with the argument I've presented so far, then we can move on to the next slide. And we'll look at three main areas where communicable diseases may may have an impact and climate change may have an impact on them. We'll look at waterborne diseases, vector-borne diseases, and food-borne diseases quite quickly. Move on to the next slide, then we'll look at waterborne disease. The evidence in the literature suggests that there is a risk of infection due to flooding, and this is more likely to impact upon poorer countries. I think we can see the logic of that. Those of us that have read the news, read the newspapers and seen the stories in the press, then we know that in the past that we've seen the problems with flooding in less developed countries. And I'm thinking things like the flooding that we've seen in the Indian subcontinent around Bangladesh and places where they haven't had the same kind of public health facilities and the same medical facilities as we might have in more developed countries. Then it's logical to see that that may well easily have a greater impact upon poorer countries. The evidence also suggests that the risk of flooding is likely to have less impact upon countries like the UK and other developed nations. The caveat would be that this reduced risk or less risk is likely to be so unless water sources themselves are breached. And I don't think in the UK, certainly in the UK, I don't think we can be quite entirely happy that doesn't happen. There certainly have been occasions in the UK where we've had outbreaks of cryptosporidia, and we've had some fairly large outbreaks in Tor Bay, I think in the 1990s, and again in South Wales and North Wales in the last few years, where I think we had something over 200 cases, where there certainly was a suggestion that mains water supplies had become contaminated with crypto, and that was the source of the cryptosporidia infection. So, yes, we can reassure ourselves that flooding may not be an immediate problem unless those water sources are breached. But we also need to be quite clear that yes, it does, it has happened, or appears to have happened in the past, and we should be kind of forewarned and on our guard to make sure that kind of thing doesn't happen again. Continuing with waterborne disease, we move on to the next slide. I mean, you can see that the literature again suggests that climate change and heavy rainfall events have a role in the changing patterns of infection in temperate regions. And it's these kind of heavy rainfall events that do seem to be happening increasingly within these temperate areas. And I'm referring to the area that I find myself in the UK and in Cornwall, where we certainly have had freakishly unusual heavy rainfall events in the last few years that haven't been documented previously. We'll talk about one later on, which was at the time reported as being something like a one in 200 years occurrence. It was that freakishly unusual. But then there was another one very similar to it that occurred shortly afterwards. So then you have to ask yourself, is this really a one in 200 years occurrence, or is there something going on? Is the patterns of the weather patterns changing, or are the weather patterns changing in this particular area? And there's also the argument that outbreaks of infection associated with drinking water and associated with heavy rainfall events immediately preceding the onset of an outbreak. You can imagine, if you can think of the water that's coming into the catchment area of the mains water supply, and you can imagine that there's the water's coming down from the fields where the rain's been raining onto the fields and onto the land. This land's been grazed by various animals, and you can see that there's likely to be runoff of the rainfall from the fields, and that runoff is quite likely to be contaminated with feces, and that feces might itself be contain things like cryptosporidia and giardia. So you can see, hopefully you can see the potential for how those pathogens might be transported from the host organism, cattle, goats, sheep, whatever, into the feces, onto the land, and then with some kind of freakish rainfall event, there'll be a runoff of water, which will then find its way into the drains and into watercourses, and then in the fullness of time, it'll find its way into the water supply, where, of course, then it would normally be treated and it won't present a problem. If we move on to the next slide, and we'll continue with waterborne disease. The thing that I think is interesting here, and this is where I start to think about the behavior of the organisms that are involved in any potential outbreak, we can see that those kind of rainfall events that we've just been talking about, they're likely to increase the prevalence of organisms such as Cryptosporidia and Giardia within these streams and other recreational waters. Now, you'll probably just see there's a link below there. I'll just put the cursor on it. For those of us that aren't microbiologists by training, I thought it might be helpful just to have some explanatory notes. I'm sorry if this is all known to you, and I don't really mean to be insulting if this is all known to you, but I just thought I'd quickly give some kind of explanatory notes on the organisms that we're talking about, just in case anybody isn't familiar with them. So there you can see a quick note on Cryptosporidia, and there's a quick note on Giardia as well. Again, apologies if this is all already known to you, but I thought it just might help if we're dealing with organisms that people aren't immediately familiar with. And you can come back to those, I imagine, if and when you choose to. Yep. So I think an interesting point to make there is at the end of that bullet point, the Cryptosporidia and Giardia within streams, rivers, and other recreational waters. So the fact that you're now getting an increased contamination of recreational waters means that you're presenting an increasing risk of exposure to a susceptible host. So I remember as I was going through the literature, and I remember reading about this, about types of things that will increase the risk and increase the prevalence of the infectious organism. I remember thinking that, yes, but this will also increase the prevalence of the susceptible host. So I'm just speculating that one day in the UK we might actually have a nice prolonged dry summer, in which case we could all get out and start to enjoy some recreational waters rather than being constantly being rained on. If that were to be the case, then you can see that the susceptible host, the humans, would be quite happily out trying to be as recreational as possible, and that might then increase their exposure to what we already suppose may well be an increased bacterial load or pathogenic load within those recreational waters. If we move on to the next slide, still discussing waterborne disease. There's also evidence to suggest that rising temperatures may also contribute to toxic blooms, toxic algal blooms. And these may well be detrimental to health, and they may be found in freshwater and sea waters, and they can be an irritant. I know that, I know that they can be an irritant. But there is also evidence to suggest that in some parts of the world that these algal blooms can provide some kind of support for cholera. It's unlikely to be a problem in the UK, but as I said earlier, there may occasionally... Here we go. Well, I beg your pardon, I think I might have clicked the slide early. We should now be on waterborne diseases, increased with a bullet point there, increased incidence of cholera associated with algal blooms. And I'll just click back on that link there. Again, apologies, but if you're not familiar with what cholera is and what it does, again, there's a link there just to give a little bit of background information. I'm losing my way with the slides at the moment. You might have guessed that. Maria's doing her best to guide me, but I'll appear to have jumped the slide or two. Increased incidence of cholera associated with such algal blooms. The evidence suggests that we're unlikely to see that in places like the UK and in temperate areas. There is some evidence to suggest that there will be parts of the world where algal blooms may well be found to be increasing in their support of cholera and increasing the risk. But that's likely to be in places such as off the coast of Bangladesh. And I also think there's some evidence to suggest that there has been research which showed increased risk of transmission of cholera along the Latin American coast as well. And again, I've got references and literature at the end of the talk where you can see. So move on to the next slide. The literature suggests that the impact of a warmer climate on waterborne disease in the UK is likely to come from problems with it, with the actual processing of the drinking water supplies. And it's thought that if there were to be a problem, then the main risk would be in this topic of chemical coagulation used in the treatment of drinking waters. For those of you not familiar, I can't claim to be a kind of a water hygiene scientist, but in chemical coagulation, what happens is that, unsurprisingly, a coagulant is added to the water, usually something like an iron or aluminium salts, and that's added to the water during the treatment process. And the aim of that is to help the bonding of particles and particulates within the water as it's being processed, and it's as the particulates are gathered together, and that aids with the filtration of it, and then move on to the next stage of the water processing. But you can imagine this may well be kind of the role of these coagulants might be impacted by temperature. So an increasing temperature might have an impact on the effectiveness of these chemical coagulation coagulants. And then as a result of that, we might see a problem with reduced elimination of microorganisms from the treated water. And therefore, you can see that there may well be a potential increased risk because of the fact that the water just may not be as clear as we might want it to be. And then moving on to the next slide, which now you should still be on waterborne disease. Hopefully we've all caught up with each other after my little technical hitch for the slides here. This one should now start with UK Department of Health / HPA. And their advice is on enhanced monitoring, risk management, particularly during extreme weather events such as droughts or unusually heavy rainfall. And you can see this is kind of coming back again to the kind of basic infection control stuff that I imagine many of us are familiar with. We'll all be familiar, I'd imagine, with types of surveillance and enhanced surveillance. If we know or we suspect that there might be an increased risk, then we deliberately set out to try and find that. And that might be the thing that we do with enhanced surveillance. If we know that there's going to be a risk, if we know that there's going to be an extreme weather event, such as heavy rainfall, and we are fairly confident that as a result of that, there may be increased runoff, there may be increased contamination of recreational water courses, then we could start to be a bit more proactive in our surveillance and our observation. So this is the kind of thing that many of us are familiar with, and being familiar with it, and we know how, that we can use this kind of enhanced surveillance to inform our policy and our preparations, and we can be forewarned with the risks associated with these extreme weather events, and we can be prepared for it as best we possibly can. So that's the UK Department of Health and HPA advice. Certainly from looking at it from a UK point of view, it doesn't appear that we should be hugely concerned at the moment, but we do need to be monitoring, and we need to be aware of the risks. Maria is trying to hurry me up now. She's telling me that I need to go faster, so I shall. I'll try to stop waffling so much. We should now be on to the next slide, which is vector-borne disease. And you can see here that in terms of vector-borne disease, we, according to the literature and the evidence, suggests that we should be expecting an increase in ambient temperatures, certainly within the UK. That's what the evidence suggests that we should expect to see. We may well expect to see increased flooding, and as a result of flooding, we might see an increase in the spread of vectors, because we're going to have more wet land, it's going to be warmer, therefore we can see that other vectors might thrive on that, such as mosquitoes. There is a suggestion that diseases such as malaria may then be seen to increase, and the risk associated with transmission of malaria might be seen to increase with the increasing prevalence of viable kind of vectors. But moving on to the next slide, we talk about a bit more. It's thought that this is likely to present a problem only in developing countries, and that those of us that are fortunate enough to live in kind of temperate regions like the UK, we're unlikely to see a major problem with that. And if we have the kind of public health and medical structures that we normally have in these kind of countries, then we're unlikely to see a significant spread of malaria. But we need to be aware, however, that malaria in the UK has been known. It has existed in the past. It's not as though it's something that is foreign to the UK. And I think right up until the 17th century, it was a known phenomenon within the UK, and I think even Shakespeare mentioned it in a few of his plays, not by the name Malaria. I think it was some other kind of medieval term that was used, a quaternary fever or something like that. But I'm sure that Shakespeare has mentioned it at some point. So those of us in the UK, we can't be smug. We can't say, oh, no, we won't have a problem with malaria because it's been here in the past. And perhaps we should be aware of the risk and just know that we do need to be careful about it. And the potential vectors all around. There are species of mosquito within the Anopheles species within the UK that, under the right circumstances or under the ideal circumstances, could potentially be a vector that would cause problems. And of course, in Europe, malaria was known to be a problem and was once common in Europe, certainly in southern Europe. So again, we shouldn't be too happy that we are entirely safe from any problems. We should be aware of it. Moving on to the next slide, still talking about vector-borne diseases. Argument there, and certainly in the literature, there is the argument that we still need to be vigilant throughout Europe for increasing risk of things like malaria and other vector-borne diseases. And we should also be aware of the possibility of new species that being able to act opportunistically, because we all know how good organisms are able to act opportunistically. Given half a chance, if they get the chance to infect someone or to colonize something, they will. That we should be aware of the risk of new or novel species. And then moving on to the next slide. Still talking about vector-borne disease. The literature does come to the conclusion that climate change may well have a significant impact in changes that influence the prevalence of arthropod diseases within the UK and to a wider extent in Europe as well. And when we talk about arthropod diseases, we're talking about things that are transmitted by ticks, flies, and insects. And again, if you look at things, if you consider things like changing temperatures, changing environments, and they might facilitate the growth in the arthropod population, their behavior, and the public exposure to them. So if we're talking about ticks, these are the kind of things that you might pick up if you go for a walk in the woods in the countryside. And again, if you've got people that are, or a population that's more prone to taking kind of recreational walks in these areas, then it's not just the infectious organism or the vector of that infection that's where the behaviour is changing. It's also the behaviour of the host that's changing, and that's really what I'm coming around to thinking that's something that we need to be looking at more in the research. Moving on to the next slide, still on vector-borne diseases. The literature does suggest that alterations in land usage and warmer temperatures will have an impact on vectors within the UK. We can also predict that if we, for argument's sake, say we do see longer, warmer, drier summers, particularly in the UK where we normally have long, wet, windy and cool summers, if we were to get a longer, drier summers, then I can imagine that changes in human behaviour would be inevitable. And if we get a chance, we'll talk about that in a bit more detail later. And we can see that those changes, that inevitably, if those changes were to occur, they would have an impact on vector-borne disease, or at least the very risk of transmission of vector-borne disease. Moving on, there's even the suggestion that leishmaniasis might make its way into northern areas where we don't normally see it. And again, I'll just click on the link there. There's the suggestion that the sand fly, which the phlebotomine sand flies, the name gives it away, doesn't it? It likes to bite. That those sand flies might make themselves known in the areas of northern Europe where we're not likely to see them these days. And of course, that would bring a whole new risk and a whole new different problem for us to experience. And just a quick note there about leishmaniasis. Again, you can come back to that at your leisure and have a read through that if you wish. It seems unlikely, and hopefully that we won't see problems with that sand fly moving north. If we move on to the next slide. The there certainly is evidence to suggest that these vector species are responding to climate change, and they are there are these latitudinal shifts in the populations of these vectors, ticks. Latitudinal shifts, in other words, they're moving north gradually. So things that we might have seen in southern Europe and beyond are slowly but surely appear to be moving further and further north and having an impact on the populations in these more northern areas. And there is this definite evidence of changes in the incidence distribution and transmission of things like tick-borne encephalitis. So for those that are wondering whether or not climate change is happening, then again, this is evidence to suggest, well, something is causing. There's definitely changes in the prevalence and the distribution and the incidence of this disease. There's something going on there, and we just have to speculate really on what that cause is. It may well be climate change, and that's what we're assuming it is at the moment. On to the next slide there. Vector-borne disease, unlikely that tick-borne encephalitis would become a major problem in the UK, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that that's not going to be a major problem for us. If we look at vector-borne disease and vectors generally, you can see that there are these multiple factors that will impact upon that. Changes in land use, precipitation, water levels, moisture, these can all have an impact on the vector-borne infectious diseases, and they can also have an impact on the behavior of the vectors themselves. And I was mentioned about a pseudo-outbreak, and I keep calling it a pseudo-outbreak because there was no actual pathogens transmitted. No one actually became infected. But in this particular occurrence, there was a small town where some previously dry marshland had become increasingly moist and damp and began to be very, very adept at supporting large populations of mosquitoes. And these mosquitoes then migrated into the nearby town, and members of the population were quite concerned that there was a fairly large number of mosquitoes flying around, and they were seen within this small town. And people were starting to attribute their symptoms to being bitten by the mosquitoes. And this took quite a bit of investigation to establish that, no, there wasn't any transmission of pathogens. Yes, these mosquitoes were there, but they were unlikely to present a health risk. But again, caused a lot of concern within the population, needed to be managed, and the risk needed to be explained and needed to be dealt with. So it's not just a matter of pathogens, it's the vectors themselves and the changing behavior of the vectors and the potential human hosts. Again, we need to consider that in the whole and the complicated relationship between the three, really. Moving on to the next slide. We said earlier on about malaria and the lack of, hopefully lack of risk of that in the UK, that we won't be seeing too much of that. And again, for those of you that aren't familiar with malaria, I've included a little link there so you can have a look at some explanatory notes there. I think I have to move on a bit faster because otherwise Maria will start gesticulating at me again. Another vector-borne disease, we've got Lyme disease. We can see there that agricultural workers and other people involved in rural leisure activities, again, if they are going out and they're spending more leisure time in rural areas where there's more likely to be ticks, they are themselves likely to be more exposed to those disease-causing ticks and the Borrelia, and the Lyme disease that those ticks are carrying. And again, there's a little explanatory note. And again, I'm coming back to the same kind of result, or the same kind of conclusion. It's not just the behavior of the pathogen that's likely to change. It's not just the behavior of the vector that's likely to change as a result of climate change. It's the pathogen, it's the vector, and it's the host as well. And again, it's that relationship between the three that, to my mind, could well make things a bit more complicated for us and how we're going to manage these potential problems. And again, moving on to the next slide, you can see that vector-borne disease, the suggestion from the Department of Health and the HPN UK, again, falling back on tried and tested, well-known and well-trusted solutions such as surveillance, planning and preparation. Moving on to our third area, into foodborne disease. And we can see that food poisoning, there is evidence to suggest that food poisoning associated with climate change and flooding is likely to be a problem. And many of us realise the effect of higher temperatures on food storage and food hygiene. Those of us that have been involved in public health and communicable disease control, we're all aware that higher temperatures will have an impact on food storage and food hygiene. Moving on to the next slide. We can see here, rising temperatures and increased risk of flooding are likely to affect the distribution of diarrheal disease and risk of food contamination. If we think of agricultural intensification as a result of climate change, if we have that kind of agricultural intensification because of droughts, so we need to move animals indoors and we need to hold them together and we need to try and intensify their ability to produce food, then that might see the increase in the use of antibiotics in food production and in animal husbandry, and that might then have the knock-on kind of selective pressure for antibiotic-resistant pathogens within those groups of animals that are brought in close together. We've seen that in the past with kind of the factory manufacturing of things like poultry, where you bring animals together. There does seem to be an increased risk of transmission of diseases. And if we think about, if we have an imaginary scenario of a dry, hot summer, maybe there's a drought and the land and the fields on which the animals might normally graze, it's just not suitable anymore. It may be necessary to shelter the animals, bring them indoors, bring them close together, and then again, you can see that there's going to be that increased risk of transmission right at the very beginning of the food chain. So you can see the potential risk of contamination there. Move on to the next slide. Sorry, that's Maria reminding me again. Unsurprisingly, the greatest risk of diarrhea will occur in populations in developing countries, and those of us fortunate enough to be in Western developed countries are likely to see less problem. Moving on to the next slide, we can see that food contamination might also result from flooding. Those of us that have seen pictures of the flooding in the UK, we can imagine that just what on earth is floating around in that water as it's covering the drains, covering industrial areas, and then moving on into the kind of agricultural production areas. Goodness knows what that agricultural production area is being contaminated with. So we can see plenty of scope for contamination of food and foodstuffs right at the very beginning of the food chain through uncontrolled floodwater. Just move on to the next slide, and I think I might finish on time if I speak quickly. We can see that the HPA and the Department of Health indicate that there is this increased risk of diarrheal disease, such as Salmonella, and the role for this in foodborne disease. So things like the storage of food, temperature, impact on temperature on the storage of food, and the impact of temperature on the reheating of food. And again, if you wish, there's a link there that you can use, and that will take you to information on Salmonella. Moving on to the next slide, you can see that there is this advice to improve standards in all stages of the food chain. So we've talked earlier there about the potential for food to be contaminated right at the very beginning of the food chain. And that we should act to mitigate against the potential impacts of climate change. We should also look at it all the way through the food chain. It's right at the so it's just not just producers but consumers as well. So again, it can be very, very simple and very basic. If we take, for example, an imaginary scenario where we do have a warm, dry summer in a temperate area such as the UK. Now, we can speculate, if we did have a warm, dry summer, I would almost put a month's wages on the fact that we would see an increased occurrence of barbecues. And one example from my own practice where there was must have been a very, very friendly neighbourhood where there was a barbecue that took place one evening. I think most of the street must have attended this particular barbecue. And I'm not sure that the cooking at the barbecue was particularly good because, sure enough, we had a huge instance of food poisoning, and on investigation, it was associated with that particular barbecue. What were the factors behind it? Well, there was a man standing there doing his barbecue best with a large quantity of alcohol around him, and no, the food wasn't cooked particularly well. And sure enough, people ended up with bacterial
food poisoning that could be very, very readily associated and linked back to this particular barbecue. So although we can look at things right back at the beginning of the food chain, again, we need to look at it at all ends, and it could just be something as simple as someone who's had a few too many operating a barbecue and not getting it right and people suffering as a result. Hopefully, I have now made an argument that there is going to be an impact from there is likely to be an impact from climate change. If there is going to be an impact from climate change on infectious disease and communicable diseases, then we might see it in vector-borne, we might see it in waterborne, and we might see it in foodborne illness. If we accept that that's a problem, then we need to move on to our next slide and start to think, well, how can we adapt to and how can we mitigate against that? And I think we have to accept that there is likely to be a problem. There is definitely evidence to suggest that there is almost certainly going to be a problem that we will have to do something. Move on to the next slide. The argument is that this mitigation and adaptation is going to be based upon risk management. And we need to start thinking of the way that we manage risk in the ways that we manage other types of risk, flu pandemic planning. We need to start planning ahead. We need to use our surveillance and our enhanced surveillance and our data that we can, so that we can get ourselves ready. We can use tried and trusted infection control methods to be prepared and be ready for the kind of problems that we might encounter in the future. And the kind of things that we might focus upon. All this, moving on to the next slide, still on adaptation and mitigation, communicable disease control, what we might focus on. And again, these are all things that I imagine that we're fairly familiar with. So our policy responses need to be strategic, they need to be tactical, they need to be based upon a risk, feasible, and they should be implementable as well, and involve a variety of stakeholders, people that will be involved in this. Moving on to the next one. We might also look at future land use and strategies to make sure that things do not worsen. For argument, a development I was involved in where there was talk of using a brownfield site, there's an old industrial site, and using it for residential land use. This site was prone to risk of flooding. We could see that it was acknowledged, and so a health impact assessment was carried out, and sure enough, changes were made or had to be made to this potential land development. Moving on, still on adaptation and mitigation. Again, we can see there that we need to be imaginative with the people that we're going to involve in this kind of thing. Forestry Commission, they might help us with things like management of exposure to ticks. Tourist advice, again, with things like exposure to pathogens in wastewater. And waste management, are we going to be able to get rid of our waste in a safe manner without increasing any further risk? Moving on. Just quickly then, in the last few minutes, there is evidence available of these changes in extreme weather events associated with climate change, and I'll just quickly go through one with you now. Move on to the next slide. There's a typical Cornish beach. I wish. Don't really look like anything like that. That's more like it. For those who aren't familiar with this, this is a town in North Cornwall called Boscastle. Made its way into the news a few years ago where it was the victim of a highly unusual, freakish rainfall event where the village was just flooded and large sections of the village were washed away. Amazingly enough, other areas of Cornwall nearby didn't see a drop of rain. Very odd, very freakish. Moving on to the next slide. These are kinds of extreme rainfall events that will increase surface water runoff, as we talked earlier about pathogens and surface water running off into watercourses. Moving on. So this beach outbreak should have the slide there. Beach outbreak in August 2004, there were these 7 cases, all with E. coli 157. There's an explanatory note for you at the bottom there about E. coli 157. All 7 of these cases had stayed in different sites within the Cornwall area, but had all, moving on, all 7 cases had visited a seaside beach which had a stream across it. All 7 cases had the same organism with the same phage type.
which is fairly indicative that it was all from the same point source. Moving on, there should now be a nice picture in front of you of a genuine Cornish beach with a stream going across it. That's the kind of thing that we're dealing with. Increased numbers of coliforms were found in that stream, and it was certainly found that cattle were grazing upstream. And the evidence is that the source of the outbreak of a 157 was from this contaminated stream flowing across the beach. Now, it's worth noting, that's the kind of stream that we're talking about, and this is the high tide level. You can see that there's quite a bit of surf here. So just to put yourself in the place of the parents, you've got small children, toddlers. Where would be, in your mind, would be the safest place for those kids to be playing? In the stream. Not out in the surf, especially if they're not strong swimmers. So it's worth noting, it was the behaviour of the parents, inadvertently and unwittingly, they wanted their children to be in the safest place they could possibly put them in their minds, which was the stream, which was in itself the area with the highest load of potential pathogens in it. So again, it's this behaviour of the host that I keep coming back to. And that's just confirming what we just said. It's felt that the heavy rainfall, moving on to the next slide, it's felt that heavy rainfall in those days, around the time of that Boscastle flooding and around about the time of this outbreak, it was a freakishly heavy rain, a bolus of contaminated water could, moving on to the next slide, a bolus of contaminated water moved into these bathing areas, and that's why these children were put at exposed increased risk. So that's why I'm arguing that these kind of freakish weather events, that's the kind of thing that we might see as a result of climate change. Moving on to the next slide. And that's the kind of thing that we should be prepared for, maybe, if we do accept that there will be changes in the way that climate change impacts upon infectious diseases. Now, the point that you might have noticed I've been making or moving towards is this business of behaviour and public health. I imagine many of us are familiar with these public health messages. We're all told don't smoke, don't drink, eat healthy, exercise more, take care in the sun. So I imagine we're all familiar with it, but we have to ask ourselves, just how successful are they? We know that people still smoke, they still drink to excess, and there's an obesity epidemic in the developed world, and we still know that there's skin malignancies, and a tan is still fashionable for some anyway. So a lot of those public health messages, I argue that the response to those has at times been a bit patchy. Moving on to the next slide. So bearing that in mind, let's consider the behaviour and public health again. Let's just consider a potential climate change related scenario where we've got warmer, drier summers and you've got increased outdoor recreation activities. So you've got more and more of the population out there doing what they do recreationally in the sea, in the water courses, out in the woods, whatever. You can see that this will increase their exposure to potential pathogens. Our public health advice might well be something, well, avoid exposure to risk. Exactly the same as we have done with things like don't drink so much, don't smoke so much, don't eat so much and take more exercise. How successful do we think that those public health messages are likely to be? And then we have to start thinking about how we might go about getting those messages across and how we might manage the risk on the assumption that we're maybe not as successful as we would hope to be in getting those messages across. And that brings me on to my next slide, penultimate slide, be pleased to hear, which brings me back to basic old infection control theory, if we're looking at the behaviour of behaviour in public health. I like to bring this back to the chain of infection, something that I'm familiar with. If we think about what we've been discussing so far and we look at it in terms of the chain of infection, we have at least two organisms involved. There will at least be a causative infectious organism and there will at least be a susceptible host organism. If we're going to manage the risks or the increased risks presented by climate change and the changes in communicable disease prevalence and incidence, I would argue that we need to consider the behaviour of those or all those organisms that might be involved. So it's not just the behaviour of the infectious organism, it's not just the behaviour of the vectors that might transmit the organism. We also now have to start considering how we might change the behaviour of the susceptible host and how we might keep that behavior maintained to prevent any future impact on communicable disease control and increases in the prevalence and incidence of communicable disease as a result, as a direct result of climate change. And there, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, I thought we'd just come back to our nice old basic chain of infection there. So we've all gone around the houses and talked about lots of different things, but we've come back to our basic infection control theory that we can apply to hopefully whatever circumstances we find ourselves in. And then, as promised, at the end, I've got a list of some references here, two or three pages of references. Okay, so that's me done. I'll hand over to Maria. I'm sorry about the pace of me rushing in places there, but anyway, I hope you found it interesting. Bye.
Thanks, Andy. I don't know about you who are listening, but I thought that was a fascinating and at the same time a challenging talk to get us to look at the fact that actually we can do something. It's this major global problem, but we as individual healthcare practitioners can do our bit to hopefully mitigate some of the consequences of global warming. Unfortunately, we don't have any time for questions, but if I could point you to the Weber Training website, please feel free to post any questions that you have. Send them to me and I can forward them on to Andy. And also to finish with the rest of the British teleclass schedule for the rest of the year. So I'd like to thank all of you for tuning in today, and also to thank my colleague, soon-to-be Professor Andrew Nichols, for giving us that excellent talk. So thank you, everybody, and goodbye.